penetrate this school countless times. I have discovered it every time. If you are working with the resistance, if you contact them, if you think of contacting them, I will know, and I will destroy you. Look, I do as she asks, trying to ignore the faces and letting the images and words fade into a blur. But then I see two faces that will not fade. Two faces that, however poorly rendered, I could never ignore. Shock courses through me slowly, as if my body is fighting it, as if I don't want to believe what I see. Mira and John of Sarah. Resistance leaders, top priority, dead or alive. Reward, 10,000 marks. Nan and Pop never told me who destroyed my family. A mask, they said. Does it matter which one? And here she is. This is the woman who crushed my parents under her steel-bottomed boot, who brought the resistance to its knees by killing the greatest leaders it ever had. How did she do it? How, when my parents were such masters of concealment that few knew what they looked like, let alone how to find them? The traitor. Someone swore allegiance to the Commandant. Someone my parents trusted. Did Mazin know he was sending me into the lair of my parents' murderer? He's a stern man, but he doesn't seem like a willfully cruel one. If you cross me, the Commandant holds my eyes relentlessly, you'll join the faces on that wall. Do you understand? Ripping my gaze from my parents, I nod, trembling in my struggle not to allow my body to betray my shock. My words are a strangled whisper. I understand. Good. She goes to the door and pulls on a cord. Moments later, the one-eyed girl appears to escort me downstairs. The Commandant closes the door behind me, and anger rises in me like a sickness. I want to turn around and attack the woman. I want to scream at her. You killed my mother, who had a lion's heart, and my sister, who laughed like the rain, and my father, who captured truth with a few strokes of a pen. You took them from me. You took them from this world. But I don't turn back. Darren's voice comes to me again. Save me, Liar. Remember why you're here. To spy. Skies. I didn't notice anything in the Commandant's office except for her wall of death. The next time I go in, I have to pay closer attention. She doesn't know I can read. I might learn something just by glancing at the papers on her desk. My mind occupied, I barely hear the feather-light whisper of the girl as it drifts past my ear. You're right. Though she is only a few inches smaller than me, she seems tiny somehow, her stick-thin body swimming in her dress, her face pinched and frightened, like that of a starved mouse. A morbid part of me wants to ask her how she lost her eye. I'm fine, I say. Don't think I got on her good side, though. She doesn't have a good side. That's clear enough. What's your name? I don't have a name, the girl says. None of us do. Her hand strays to her eye patch, and I suddenly feel sick. Is that what happened to this girl? She told someone her name, and she had her eye gouged out. Be careful, she says softly. The Commandant sees things, knows things she shouldn't. The girl hurries ahead of me, as if wishing to physically escape the words she'd just spoken. Come, I'm supposed to take you to cook. We make our way to the kitchen, and as soon as I walk in, I feel better. The space is wide, warm and well lit, with a giant hearth and stove squatting in one corner and a wooden work table sprawled in the center. The roof drips with strings of shriveled red peppers and paper-skinned onions. A spice-laden shelf runs along one wall, and the scent of lemon and cardamom permeates the air. If not for the largeness of the place, I could be back in Nan's kitchen. A stack of dirty pots rises from a sink, and a kettle of water boils on the stove. Someone has laid out a tray with biscuits and jam. A small, white-haired woman in a diamond-patterned dress, identical to mine, stands at the work table, chopping an onion with her back to us. Beyond her is a screen door that leads outside. "Cook," the girl says. "This is... kitchen girl." The woman addresses her without turning. Her voice is strange, raspy, as if she's ill. "Didn't I ask you to wash those pots hours ago?" Kitchen girl doesn't get a chance to protest. "Stop your dawdling and get to it," the woman snaps, "or you'll be sleeping with an empty belly, and I'll not feel a shred of guilt." When the girl grabs her apron, Cook turns from her onion, and I stifle a gasp, trying not to gawp at the ruin of her face. Ropey, vivid red scars run from her forehead down across her cheeks, lips, and chin, all the way into the high neck of her black dress. It looks as though a wild animal clawed her to shreds, and she had the misfortune of surviving. Only her eyes, a dark agate blue, remain whole. "Who?" She takes me in, standing unnaturally still. Then, without explanation, she turns and limps out the back door. I look at Kitchen Girl for aid. "I didn't mean to stare." "Cook?" Kitchen Girl moves timidly to the door, opening it a crack. "Cook?" When no response comes, Kitchen Girl glances between me and the door. The kettle on the stove whistles shrilly. "It's nearly 9th bell," she twists her hands together. "That's when the Commandant has evening tea. You're to take it up, but if you're late, the Commandant, she'll..." "She'll what?" She'll be angry." Terror, true animal terror, fills the girl's face. "Right," I say. Kitchen Girl's fear is contagious, and I hurriedly pour water from the kettle into the mug on the tray. "How does she take it? Sugar? Cream?" "She takes cream." The girl rushes to a cupboard and pulls out a covered pail, spilling some of the milk. "Oh, here." I take the pail from her and spoon out the cream, trying to stay calm. "See? All done. I'll just clean up. There's no time." The girl shoves a tray into my arms and pushes me toward the hall. "Please, hurry. It's almost..." The bells begin to toll. "Go," the girl says. "Get up there before the last bell." The stairs are steep and I'm walking too fast. The tray lists, and I barely have a chance to grab the cream pot before the teaspoon clatters to the ground. The bell tolls for a 9th time and falls silent. "Calm down, liar. This is ridiculous. The Commandant probably won't even notice if I'm 5 seconds late, but she will notice if the tray is in disarray." I balance the tray in one hand and sweep up the spoon, taking a moment to neaten the crockery before approaching the door. It swings open as I raise my hand to knock. The tray is out of my arms, the cup of hot tea sailing past my head and exploding against the wall behind me. I'm still gaping when the Commandant pulls me into her office. "Turn around!" My whole body shakes as I turn to face the closed door. I don't register the zing of wood cutting through the air until the Commandant's riding crop slices into my back. The shock of it drops me to my knees. It comes down thrice more before I feel her hands in my hair. I yelp as she brings my face close to hers, the silver of her mask nearly touching my cheeks. I clench my teeth shut against the pain, forcing back tears as I think of the slaver's words. "The Commandant would rather put a sim in you than deal with tears." "I don't tolerate tardiness," she says, her eyes eerily calm. "It won't happen again." "Yes, Commandant." My whisper is no louder than kitchen girls had been. It hurts too much to speak any louder. The woman releases me. Clean up the mess in the hall. Report to me tomorrow morning at 6:00. The commandant steps around me, and moments later, the front door slams shut. The silverware rattles as I pick up the tray. Only 4 lashes, and I feel as if my skin has been torn open and drenched in salt. Blood drips down the back of my shirt. I want to be logical, practical, the way Pop taught me to be when dealing with injuries. Cut the shirt off, my girl. Clean the wounds with witch hazel and pack them with turmeric. Then bandage them and change the dressings twice a day. But where will I get a new shirt? Witch hazel, how will I bandage the wounds with no one to help me? For Darin. For Darin. For Darin. But what if he's dead? A voice whispers in my head. What if the resistance doesn't find him? What if I'm about to put myself through hell for nothing? No. If I let myself go down that path, I won't make it through the night, let alone survive weeks of spying on the commandant. As I pile shards of ceramic on the tray, I hear a rustle on the landing. I look up, cringing, terrified the commandant has returned. But it's only kitchen girl. She kneels beside me and silently mops up the spilled tea with a cloth. When I thank her, her head jerks up like a startled deer's. She finishes mopping and scurries down the stairs. Back in the empty kitchen, I place the tray in the sink and collapse at the work table, letting my head fall into my hands. I'm too numb for tears. It occurs to me then that the commandant's office door is probably still open, her papers strewn about, visible to anyone with the courage to look. Commandant's gone, liar. Go up there and see what you can find. Darin would do it. He'd see this as the perfect chance to gather information for the resistance. But I'm not Darin. And in this moment, I can't think about the mission or the fact that I'm a spy, not a slave. All I can think about is the throbbing in my back and the blood soaking my shirt. You won't survive, the commandant, Keenan had said. The mission will fail. I lower my head to the table, closing my eyes against the pain. He was right. Skies. He was right.
Part 2. The Trials. Chapter 14. Elias. The rest of leave disappears, and in no time, Grandfather is pelting me with advice as we roll toward Blackcliff in his ebony carriage. He spent half of my leave introducing me to the heads of powerful houses, and the other half railing at me for not solidifying as many alliances as possible. When I told him I wanted to go visit Helene, he'd gone apoplectic.
The girls befuddling your senses, he'd raged. Can't you spot a siren when you see one?
I choke back a laugh, remembering this now, imagining Helene's face if she knew she was being referred to as a siren. Part of me feels sorry for Grandfather. He is a legend, a general who has won so many battles that no one counts them anymore. The men in his legions worshipped him, not only for his courage and cunning, but for his uncanny ability to evade death, even when facing appalling odds. But at 77, he's long since ceased leading men into border wars, which probably explains his fixation on the trials. Regardless of his reasoning, his advice is sound. I do need to prepare for the trials, and the best way to do that is to get more information about them. I'd hoped the augurs had, at some point in time, expanded on their original prophecy, perhaps even described what the aspirants should expect. but despite combing through Grandfather's extensive library, I found nothing.
Damn you! Listen to me!
Grandfather kicks me with a steel-toed boot, and I grab the seat of the carriage, pain shooting through my leg.
Have you heard a word I've said?
The trials are a test of my mettle. I might not know what's in store, but I must be prepared anyway. I must conquer my weaknesses and exploit competitors' weaknesses. Above all, I must remember that a Veturius is...
always victorious,
we say it together, and Grandfather nods approvingly while I try not to betray my impatience. More battles, more violence. All I want is to escape the Empire, yet here I am. True freedom of body and soul. That's what I'm fighting for, I remind myself. Not rulership. Not power. Freedom.
I wonder where your mother stands on all this, Grandfather muses.
She won't favor me, that's for sure.
No, she won't, Grandfather says. But she knows you have the best odds of winning. Kerris gains much if she backs the right aspirant, and loses much if she backs the wrong one.
Grandfather looks broodingly out the carriage window.
I've heard strange rumors about my daughter. Things I might have once laughed at. She'll do everything she can to keep you from winning this. Don't expect anything less.
When we arrive at Blackcliff amid dozens of other carriages, Grandfather crushes my hand in his grip.
You will not disappoint Jens Veturia, he informs me. You will not disappoint me.
I wince at his handshake, wondering if my own will ever be as intimidating. Helene finds me after Grandfather drives away.
Since everyone's back to witness the trials, there won't be a new crop of yearlings until the contest is over.
She waves to Demetrius, emerging from his father's carriage a few yards away.
We're still in our old barracks. And we'll keep the same class schedule as before, except instead of rhetoric and history, we have extra watches on the wall.
Even though we're full masks.
I don't make the rules, Helene says. Come on, we're late for sim training.
We push through the throng of students toward Blackcliff's front gate.
Did you find anything on the trials?
I ask Hel. Someone taps my shoulder, but I ignore them. Probably an earnest cadet trying to make class on time.
Nothing, Hel says. Stayed up all night in Father's library, too.
Same here.
Damn. Peter Aquilus is a jurist, and his library is filled with everything from obscure law books to ancient scholar tomes on mathematics. Between him and Grandfather, we have most relevant books in the Empire covered. There's nowhere else to search.
We should check the...
What, damn it?
The tapping grows insistent, and I turn, intending to tell off the cadet. Instead, I'm faced with a slave girl looking up at me through impossibly long eyelashes. A heated, visceral shock flares through me at the clarity of her dark gold eyes. For a second, I forget my name. I've never seen her before. Because if I had, I'd remember. Despite the heavy silver cuffs and high, painful-looking bun that mark all of Blackcliff's drudges, nothing about her says slave. Her black dress fits her like a glove, sliding over every curve in a way that makes more than one head turn. Her full lips and fine, straight nose would be the envy of most girls, scholar or not. I stare at her. Realize I'm staring, tell myself to stop staring, and then keep staring. My breath falters, and my body, traitor that it is, tugs me forward until there are only inches between us.
Aspirant Veturius?
It's the way she says my name, like it's something to fear, that brings me back to myself.
Pull it together, Veturius.
I step away, appalled at myself when I see the terror in her eyes.
What is it?
I ask calmly.
The Commandant has requested you and Aspirant Aquila to report to her office at Sixth Bell.
Sixth Bell? Aline shoved past the gate guards toward the Commandant's house, apologizing to a group of yearlings when she knocks two of them over.
We're late. Why didn't you summon us sooner?
The girl trails us, too frightened to get closer.
There were so many people. I couldn't find you.
Aline waves off the girl's explanation.
She's going to kill us. It must be about the trials, Elias. Maybe the augurs told her something.
Aline hurries ahead, clearly still hoping to make it to my mother's office on time.
Are the trials starting?
The girl claps her hands over her mouth.
I'm sorry,
she whispers.
I...
It's all right. I don't smile at her. It will only scare her. For a female slave, a smile from a mask is not usually a good thing. I'm actually wondering the same thing. What's your name?
Slave girl.
Of course. My mother would already have scourged her name out of existence. Right. You work for the Commandant. I want her to say no. I want her to say that my mother roped her into this. I want her to say she's assigned to the kitchens or the infirmary, where slaves aren't scarred or missing body parts. But the girl nods in response to my question. Don't let my mother break you, I think. The girl meets my eyes, and there is that feeling again, low and hot and consuming. Don't be weak. Fight. Escape. A gust of wind whips a strand free from her bun and across her cheekbone. Defiance flashes across her face as she holds my gaze, and for a second, I see my own desire for freedom mirrored, intensified in her eyes. It's something I've never detected in the eyes of a fellow student, let alone a scholar slave. For one strange moment, I feel less alone. But then she looks down, and I wonder at my own naivete. She can't fight. She can't escape. Not from Blackcliff. I smile joylessly. In this, at least, the slave and I are more similar than she'll ever know. When did you start here? I ask her.
3 days ago, Sir Aspirant,
She wrings her hands. Veturius is fine. She walks carefully, gingerly. The Commandant must have whipped her recently, and yet she doesn't hunch or shuffle like the other slaves. The straight-backed grace with which she moves tells her story better than words. She'd been a free woman before this. I'd bet my Sims on it, and she has no idea how pretty she is, or what kind of problems her beauty will cause for her at a place like Blackcliff. The wind pulls at her hair again, and I catch her scent, like fruit and sugar. Can I give you some advice? Her head flies up like a scared animal's. At least she's wary. Right now, you will grab the attention of every male in a square mile. Stand out, I finish. It's hot, but you should wear a hood or a cloak, something to help you blend in. She nods, but her eyes are suspicious. She wraps her arms around herself and drops back a little. I don't speak to her again. When we arrive at my mother's office, Marcus and Zack are already seated, clad in full battle armor. They fall silent as we enter, and it's obvious they've been talking about us. The Commandant ignores Helene and me and turns from her window, where she's been staring out at the dunes. She motions the slave girl close, then backhands her so hard that blood flies from her mouth.
I said Sixth Bell.
Anger floods me, and the Commandant senses it.
Yes, Veturius?
Her lips purse, and she tilts her head as if to say, Do you wish to interfere and bring my wrath down upon yourself? Helene elbows me, and, fuming, I keep quiet. Get out! Mother says to the trembling girl. Aquila, Veturius, sit. Marcus watches the slave as she leaves. The lust on his face makes me want to push the girl out of the room faster, while gouging the snake's eyes out. Zack, meanwhile, ignores the girl and glances surreptitiously at Helene. His angular face is pale, and purple shadows darken his eyes. I wonder how he and Marcus spent their leave. Helping their plebeian father with his smithing. Visiting family. Plotting ways to kill me and Helene.
The augurs are otherwise occupied.
A strange, smug smile creeps onto the commandant's face.
And have asked that in their stead, I give you the details of the trials. Here.
The commandant slides a piece of parchment across her desk, and we all lean forward to read it.
Four they are, and four traits we seek. Courage to face their darkest fears. Cunning to outwit their foes. Strength of arms and mind and heart. Loyalty to break the soul. It is a foretelling. You'll learn its meaning in the coming days.
The commandant faces her window again, her hands behind her back. I watch her reflection, unnerved at the self-satisfaction oozing off her.
The augurs will plan and judge the trials, but since this contest is meant to weed out the weak, I have proposed to our holy men that you remain at Blackcliff for the duration of the trial. The augurs agreed.
I stifle a snort. Of course the augurs agreed. They know this place is hell, and they'll want the trials to be as difficult as possible.
I have ordered the centurions to intensify your training to reflect your status as aspirants. I have no say in your conduct during the competition. However, outside the trials, you are still subject to my rules, my punishments.
She begins to pace her office, and her eyes stab into me, warning of whippings and worse.
If you win a trial, you will receive a token from the augurs, a prize of sorts. If you pass a trial but do not win, your reward is your life. If you fail a trial, you will be executed.
She lets that pleasant fact sink in for a moment before going on.
The aspirant who wins two trials first will be named victor. Whoever comes in second, with one win, will be named Bloodshrike. The others will die. There will be no tie. The augurs wish me to stress that while the trials are taking place, the accepted rules of sportsmanship apply. You will not engage in cheating, sabotage, or chicanery.
I glance at Marcus. Telling him not to cheat is like telling him not to breathe.
What about Emperor Tyus? Marcus says. The Bloodshrike. The Black Guard. Jen's Tyre isn't just going to disappear. Tyus will retaliate.
The Commandant passes behind me, and my neck prickles unpleasantly.
He has left Antium with his gens, and is heading south to disrupt the trials. But the augurs shared another foretelling. Waiting vines circle and strangle the oak. The way is made clear just before the end. What's that supposed to mean?
Marcus asks.
It means that the Emperor's actions are not our concern. As for the Bloodshrike and Black Guard, their loyalty lies with the Empire, not Tyus. They will be the first to pledge themselves to the new dynasty. When do the trials begin?
Helene asks.
They may commence at any time.
My mother finally sits and steeples her fingers, her expression remote.
And they may take any form. From the moment you leave this office, you must be prepared. If they can take any form, Zack speaks up for the first time, then how are we supposed to prepare? How will we know they've begun? You'll know, the Commandant says. But you'll know.
She stares directly at Zack, and he falls silent.
Any other questions?
The Commandant doesn't wait for a response.
Dismissed.
We salute and file out. Not wanting to turn my back on the snake and the toad, I let them go ahead of me, but immediately regret it. The slave girl stands in the shadows near the stairs, and as Marcus passes her, he reaches out and yanks her close. She writhes in his grasp, trying to break his iron grip on her throat. He leans down and murmurs something to her. I reach for my sim, but Helene grabs my arm.
Commandant,
she warns me. Behind us, my mother watches from her study door, arms crossed.
It's her slave,
Helene whispers.
You'd be a fool to interfere.
Aren't you going to stop him? I turn to the Commandant, keeping my voice low.
She's a slave,
the Commandant says, as if that explains everything.
She's to receive 10 lashes for her incompetence. If you're intent on helping her, perhaps you wish to take on her punishment. Of course not, Commandant.
Helene digs her nails into my arm and speaks for me, knowing that I'm on the verge of earning myself a whipping. She nudges me down the hall.
Leave it,
she says.
It's not worth it.
She doesn't need to explain. The Empire doesn't chance the loyalty of its masks. The Black Guard will be all over me if they hear I've taken a whipping for a scholar drudge. Ahead of me, Marcus laughs and releases the girl, then follows Zack down the stairs. The girl gulps down air, bruises blooming on her neck.
Help her, Elias.
But I can't. Hell is right. The risk of punishment is too great. Helene strides down the hall, giving me a pointed look.
Move.
The girl pulls her feet back as we pass, trying to make herself small. Disgusted with myself, I spare her no more attention than I would a heap of trash. I feel heartless as I leave her there to face Mother's punishment. I feel like a mask. That night, my dreams are travels, filled with hisses and whispers. Wind circles my head like a vulture, and I flinch from hands burning with unnatural heat. I try to wake as discomfort turns into nightmare, but I only slip deeper in, until eventually there is nothing but choking, burning light. When I open my eyes, the first thing I notice is the hard, sandy ground beneath me. The second is that the ground is hot, skin shriveling hot. My hand shakes as I shield my eyes from the sun and scan the wasted landscape around me. A lone, gnarled jack tree rises from the cracked land a few feet away. Miles to the west, a vast body of water lays shimmering like a mirage. The air reeks something horrible, a combination of carrion, rotting eggs, and cadets' quarters in high summer. The land is so pale and desolate that I might be standing on a distant, dead moon. My muscles ache, as if I've been lying in the same position for hours. The pain tells me that this is no dream. I stagger to my feet, a lonely silhouette in a vast emptiness. The trials, it seems, have begun.
Chapter 15. Liar. Dawn is still a blue rumor on the horizon when I limp into the Commandant's chambers. She sits at her dressing table, observing her reflection in the mirror. Her bed looks untouched, as it does every morning. I wonder when she sleeps, if she sleeps. She's clad in a loose black robe that softens the disdain on her masked face. It's the first time I've seen her out of uniform. The robe slips down her shoulder, and the unusual swirls of her tattoo are revealed to be part of an ornate A, the dark ink vivid against the chill paleness of her skin. 10 days have passed since my mission began, and while I haven't learned anything that will help me save Darin, I have learned how to press a black cliff uniform in 5 minutes flat, how to carry a heavy tray up the stairs with half a dozen welts on my back, and how to remain so silent that I forget my own existence. Keenan gave me only the barest details about this mission. I'm to gather information about the trials, and then, when I leave Blackcliff for my errands, the Resistance will contact me. Might take us 3 days, Keenan said, or 10. Be prepared to report every time you go into the city and never come looking for us. At the time, I'd suppressed the urge to ask him a dozen questions, like how to get the information they want, like how to keep the Commandant from catching me. Now I'm paying for it. Now I don't want the Resistance to find me. I don't want them to learn what a terrible spy I am. At the back of my mind, Darin's voice grows fainter. Find something, Lyra. Something that will save me. Hurry. No. Another louder part of me says, lay low. Don't risk spying until you're certain you won't get caught. Which voice do I listen to? The spy or the slave? The fighter or the coward? I thought the answers to such questions would be easy. That was before I learned what real fear was. For now, I move around the Commandant quietly, setting down her breakfast tray, clearing her tea from the night before, laying out her uniform. Don't look at me. Don't look at me. My pleas seem to work. The Commandant acts as if I don't exist. When I open the curtains, the first rays of morning illuminate the room. I stop to look at the emptiness beyond the Commandant's window, miles of whispering dunes rippling like waves in the dawn wind. For a second, I lose myself in their beauty. Then Blackcliff's drums thud out, a wake-up call for the entire school and half the city. Slave girl! The Commandant's impatience has me moving before she says another word. My hair! As I take a brush and pins from a table drawer, I catch a glimpse of myself in the mirror. The bruises from my run-in with Aspirant Marcus a week ago are fading, and the 10 lashes I received afterward had scabbed over. Other wounds have replaced them. 3 lashes on my legs for a dust stain on my skirt, 4 lashes on my wrists for not finishing her mending, a black eye from a skull in a foul mood. The Commandant opens a letter sitting on her dressing table. She keeps her head still as I pull back her hair, ignoring me entirely. For a second, I stand frozen, staring down at the parchment as she reads. She doesn't notice. Of course she doesn't. Scholars don't read, or so she assumes. I brush out her pale hair swiftly. Look at it, Lyra, Darin's voice. Discover what it says. She will see. She will punish me. She doesn't know you can read. She'll think you're an idiot scholar gawping at pretty symbols. I swallow. I should look. 10 days at Blackcliff, with nothing to show for it but bruises and lashes, is disastrous. When the Resistance demands a report, I won't have anything for them. What will happen to Darin then? Again and again, I glance at the mirror to make sure the Commandant is enmeshed in her letter. When I'm sure, I risk a quick look down. Too dangerous in the South, and the Commandant is not trustworthy. I advise that you return to Antium. If you must come South, travel with a small force. The Commandant shifts, and I tear my eyes away, paranoid that I've been too obvious. But she reads on, and I risk another glance. By then, she's turned the parchment over. Allies are deserting Jen's Tyre like rats fleeing a fire. I have learned that the Commandant is planning, but I do not find out what the Commandant is planning, for at that moment I look up. She's watching me, in the mirror. The marks are beautiful, I say in a choked whisper, dropping one of the hairpins. I bend to retrieve it, taking those precious seconds to hide my panic. I'll be whipped for reading something that doesn't even make any sense. Why did I let her see me? Why wasn't I more careful? I haven't seen much of words, I add. No. The woman's eyes flicker, and for a moment I think she's mocking me. Your kind doesn't need to read. She examines her hair. The right side's too low. Fix it. Though I feel like crying from relief, I keep my face carefully bland and slide another pin into her silken hair. How long have you been here, slave? 10 days, sir. Have you made any friends? This question is so preposterous coming from the Commandant that I almost laugh. Friends? At Blackcliff? Kitchen girl is too shy to talk to me, and cook only speaks to give me orders. The rest of Blackcliff's slaves live and work on the main grounds. They are silent and distant, always alone, always wary. You're here for life, girl, the Commandant says, inspecting her now finished hair. Maybe you should get to know your fellows. Here. She hands me 2 sealed letters. Take the one with the red seal to the courier's office, and the one with the black seal to Spiro Tullaman. Don't leave him without a reply. Who Spiro Tullaman is, and how to find him, I don't dare to ask. The Commandant punishes questions with pain. I take the letters and back out of the room to avoid any surprise attacks. A breath explodes out of me when I close the door. Thank the skies, the woman is too arrogant to think her scholar, Drudge, can read. As I walk down the hall, I peek at the first letter and nearly drop it. It's addressed to Emperor Tyus. What would she be corresponding with Tyus about? The trials? I run an experimental finger near the seal. Still soft, it lifts cleanly. There's a scrape behind me, and the letter falls from my hand as I whip around. My mind screams, Commandant. But the hall is empty. I pick up the letter and shove it into my pocket. It seems alive, like a snake or spider I've decided to keep as a pet. I touch the seal again before jerking my hand away. Too dangerous. But I need something to give the resistance. Every day when I leave Blackcliff to run the Commandant's errands, I fear Keenan will pull me aside and demand a report. Every day he doesn't, it's a reprieve. Eventually, I'll run out of time. I have to get my cloak, so I head to the servants' quarters in the open-air hallway just outside the kitchen. My room, like kitchen girls and cooks, is a dank hole with a low entrance and a ragged curtain that serves as a door. Inside, it's just wide enough to fit a rope pallet and a crate that serves as a side table. From here, I can hear the low tones of cook and kitchen girl speaking. Kitchen girl, at least, has been slightly friendlier than cook. She's helped me with my duties more than once, and at the end of my first day, when I thought I'd faint from the pain of the lashes I'd received, I saw her scuttle away from my quarters. When I went in, I found a healing salve and a mug of pain-numbing tea. That's as far as her friendship extends. I've asked her and cook questions, discussed the weather, complained about the Commandant. No response. I'm fairly certain that if I walked into the kitchen stark naked and squawking like a chicken, I still wouldn't get a word out of them. I don't want to approach them again, only to hit a wall of silence. But I need someone to tell me who Spiro Tullaman is, and how to find him. I enter the kitchen to find them both sweating from the heat of the blazing hearth. Lunch is baking already, my mouth waters, and I long for Nan's food. We never had much, but whatever we did have was made with love, which I now know transforms simple fare into a feast. Here, we eat the Commandant's scraps, and no matter how hungry I am, they taste like sawdust. Kitchen girl gives me a glance in greeting, and cook ignores me. The older woman perches on a rickety step stool to reach a string of garlic. She looks like she's about to fall, but when I offer a hand to brace her, she glares daggers at me. I drop my hand and stand there awkwardly for a moment. Can you tell me where to find Spiro Tullamon? Silence. Look, I say, I know I'm new, but the Commandant told me to make friends. I thought... Ever so slowly, Cook turns to me. Her face is grey, as if she might be ill. Friends. It's the first word she's said to me that isn't an order. The old woman shakes her head and takes her garlic to the counter. The anger in her strokes as she chops it is unmistakable. I don't know what I've done that's so terrible, but she won't help me now. I sigh and leave the kitchen. I'll have to ask someone else about Spiro Tullamon. He's a swordsmith, I hear a soft voice say. Kitchen girl has followed me out. She looks over her shoulder, worried Cook will hear her. You'll find him along the river, in the weapons quarter. She quickly turns, ready to walk away, and it's this more than anything else that makes me speak to her. I haven't had a conversation with a normal person in 10 days. I barely said anything other than yes, sir, and no, sir. I'm Lyra, kitchen girl, freezes. Lyra. She turns the word over in her mouth. I'm Izzy. For the first time since the raid, I smile. I'd nearly forgotten the sound of my own name. Izzy looks up toward the Commandant's room. The Commandant wants you to make friends so she can use them against you, she whispers. That's why Cook is upset. I shake my head. I don't understand. It's how she controls us. Izzy fingers her eye patch. It's the reason Cook does whatever she asks. The reason why every slave in Blackcliff does what she asks. If you do something wrong, she won't always punish you. Sometimes she'll punish the people you care about instead. Izzy's so quiet I have to lean forward to hear her. If you want to have friends, make sure she doesn't know. Make sure it's secret. She slips back into the kitchen, quick as a cat in the night. I leave for the courier's office, but I can't stop thinking about what she's told me. If the Commandant is sick enough to use the slaves' friendships against them, then it's no wonder Izzy and Cook keep their distance. Is that how Izzy lost her eye? Is that how Cook got her scars? The Commandant hasn't punished me in any permanent way, yet. But it's only a matter of time. The Emperor's letter in my pocket seems suddenly heavier, and I close my hand over it. Do I dare? The faster I get information, the faster the Resistance can save Darin, and the faster I can leave Blackcliff. I debate with myself all the way to the school's gates. When I approach, the leather-armored oxes, who usually delight in tormenting slaves, barely notice me. They're intent on 2 horsemen making their way up to the school. I use the distraction to slip quietly past. Though it's still early morning, the desert heat has set in, and I fidget under the itchy weight of the cloak I've taken to wearing. Every time I put it on, I think of Aspirant Veturius, of that unabashed fire that burned in him when he first turned to me, of his smell when he stepped close, distractingly clean and masculine. I think of his words, spoken almost thoughtfully. Can I give you some advice? I don't know what I expected of the Commandant's son. Someone like Marcus Farrar, who left me with a collar of bruises that ached for days. Someone like Helene Aquila, who spoke to me as if I was less than dirt. At the very least, I thought he'd look like his mother, blonde and wan and cold to the bone. But he is black-haired and gold-skinned, and though his eyes are the same pale grey as the Commandant's, there is no trace there of the gimlet flatness that defines most masks. Instead, when he'd met my gaze for a jolting moment, I'd seen life bursting through, chaotic and alluring beneath the shadow of the mask. I'd seen fire and desire, and my heart had thumped faster. And his mask, so strange that it sits atop his face like a thing apart. Is it a sign of weakness? It can't be. I keep hearing he's Blackcliff's finest soldier. Stop, liar. Stop thinking of him. If he's thoughtful, then there's devilry behind it. If there's fire in his eyes, it's a lust for violence. He's a mask. They're all the same. I wind my way down from Blackcliff, out of the Alustrian Quarter, and into Execution Square, home to the city's largest open-air market, as well as one of only two couriers' offices. The gallows that give the square its name sit empty. But then, the day's just begun. Darin once drew the Execution Square gallows, complete with bodies hanging from the gibbet. Nan saw the image and shuddered. "Burn it," she'd said. Darin nodded. But later that night, I caught him working on it in our room. "It's a reminder, liar," he'd said in his quiet way. "It would be wrong to destroy it." The crowds move through the square sluggishly, wilted by the heat. I have to push and elbow to make any headway, eliciting grumbles from irritated merchants and a shove from a hatchet-faced slaver. As I dart under a palanquin marked with the symbol of an Alustrian house, I spot the courier's office a dozen yards away. I slow, my fingers straying toward the letter to the Emperor. Once I hand it over, there's no getting it back. "Bags, purses, and satchels! Silk-stitched!" I need to open the note. I need to have something for the resistance. But where can I do it without anyone noticing? Behind one of the stalls? In the shadows between two tents?
"We use the finest leather and hardware."
The seal will lift cleanly enough. But I can't be jostled. If the letter tears or the seal is smudged, the Commandant will probably cut off my hand. Or my head.
"Bags, purses, and satchels. Silk-stitched."
The bag seller is right behind me, and I've a mind to tell him off. Then I smell cedarwood and glance over my shoulder to see a shirtless scholar man, his muscled torso tanned and sweating. His hair, flaming red, glows below a black cap. Shock and recognition jolt my stomach. It's Keenan. His brown eyes meet mine, and as he continues to yell out his wares, he tilts his head ever so slightly toward a side alley leading out of the square. My hands sweat in uneasy anticipation, and I make my way to the alley. What will I say to him? I have nothing, no leads, no information. Keenan doubted me from the beginning, and I am about to prove him right. Dust-coated brick houses rise four stories on either side of the alley, and the noises of the market fade. Keenan is nowhere to be seen, but a woman, draped in rags, detaches herself from a wall and approaches me. I eye her warily until she lifts her head. Through the filthy tangle of dark hair, I recognize Sana. "Follow," she mouths. I want to ask her about Darin, but she's already hurrying away. She leads me through alley after alley, not stopping until we're close to Cobbler Row, nearly a mile from Execution Square. The air is dense with the chattering of shoemakers and the gamey scents of leather and tannin and dye. I think we're going to enter the row, but Sana turns instead into the narrow space between two buildings. She heads down a set of basement stairs so grimy that they look like the inside of a chimney. Keenan opens the door at the base of the stairs before Sana can knock. He's replaced the leather bags with the black shirt and brace of knives he was wearing the first time I met him. A lock of red hair falls into his face, and he looks me over, his gaze lingering on my bruises. "Thought she might have a tail," Sana says as she pulls off the cloak and wig. "But she didn't."
"Mazin's waiting."
Keenan puts a hand on my back to nudge me forward into the narrow hallway. I wince and recoil. My lashes are still painful. His eyes cut sharply to me, and I think he's going to say something, but instead he drops his hand awkwardly, brow slightly furrowed, and leads us down the hallway and through a door. Mazin sits at a table in the room beyond, his scarred face lit by a lone candle.
"Well, liar,"
he lifts his grey eyebrows.
"What do you have for me?"
"Can you tell me about Darin first?" I ask, finally able to voice the question that has plagued me for a week and a half. "Is he all right?"
"Your brother's alive, liar."
A sigh gusts out of me, and I feel like I can breathe again.
"But I can't tell you any more until you tell me what you have. We did make a deal."
"Let her at least sit." Sunna pulls out a chair for me, and almost before I'm in it, Mazin leans forward.
"We have little time," he says. "Whatever you've got, we need."
"The trial started about a week ago." I scramble to connect the few scraps of information I do have. I'm not ready to give him the letter, not yet. If he breaks a seal or tears it, I'm done for. "That's when the aspirants disappeared. There are four of them. Their names..."
"We know all that."
Mazin dismisses my words with the wave of a hand.
"Where were they taken? When does the trial end? What's the next one?" "We've heard that two of the aspirants returned today," Keenan says. "Not long ago, in fact. Maybe half an hour."
I think of the guards talking excitedly at Blackcliff's gate as two horsemen came up the road. Liar, you fool. If I'd paid closer attention to the ox's gossip, I might have learned which aspirants had survived the trial. I might have had something useful to tell Mazin. "I don't know. It's been so hard," I say. Even as I speak, I hear how pathetic I sound and hate myself for it. "The Commandant killed my parents. She has this wall with posters of every rebel she's caught. My parents were up there. Their faces..." Sunna's eyes widen, and even Keenan looks slightly sick, his aloofness falling away for a moment. I wonder why I'm telling Mazin this. Perhaps because some part of me wonders if he knew the Commandant killed my parents. If he knew and sent me to Blackcliff anyway.
"I didn't know,"
Mazin says, sensing my unasked question.
"But it's all the more reason that this mission must succeed."
"I want to succeed more than anyone, but I can't get into her office. She never has visitors, so I can't eavesdrop on her." Mazin holds up a hand to stop me.
"What do you know, exactly?"
For one frantic moment, I consider lying. I've read 100 tales of heroes and the trials they face. What harm if I invent one and pass it off as truth? But I can't bring myself to do it. Not when the Resistance is placing their trust in me. Nothing. I stare at the floor, ashamed at the incredulity on Mazin's face. I reach for the letter, but don't pull it out. Too risky. Maybe he'll give you another chance, liar. Maybe you can try again.
"What exactly have you been doing all this time?" "Surviving, from the looks of it," Keenan says.
His dark eyes flash to mine, and I can't tell if he's defending or insulting me.
"I was loyal to the Lioness," Mazin says. "But I can't waste my time helping someone who won't help me."
"Mazin, for sky's sake," Sunna sounds aghast. "Look at the poor girl."
"Yes," Mazin eyes the bruises on my neck. "Look at her. She's a mess. The mission's too difficult. I made a mistake, liar. I thought you'd take risks. I thought you were more like your mother."
The insult levels me faster than a blow from the Commandant. Of course he's right. I'm nothing like my mother. She'd have never been in this position to begin with.
"We'll see about getting you out," Mazin shrugs and stands. We're done here. Wait! Mazin can't abandon me now. Darin is lost if he does.